These pages on Babaji merely a hint of his life, only a few facts that he deems fitting and helpful to be publicly imparted. No limiting facts about Babaji's family or birthplace, dear to the analyst's heart, have ever been discovered. His speech is generally in Hindi, but he converses easily in any language. He has adopted the simple name of Babaji, revered father. Other titles of respect given him by Lahiri Mahashaya's disciples are Mahamuni Babaji, Maharaj, Supreme Ecstatic Master, Mahayogi, the Great Yogi, and Trambak Baba or Shiva Baba, titles of avatars of Shiva. Does it matter that we know not the patronymic of a fully released master? Whenever anyone utters with reverence the name of Babaji, Lahiri Mahashaya said, that devotee attracts an instant spiritual blessing. The deathless guru bears no mark of age on his body. He appears to be a youth of not more than 25. Fair-skinned, of medium build and height, Babaji's beautiful, strong body radiates a perceptible glow. His eyes are dark, calm and tender. His long, lustrous hair is copper-coloured. Sometimes Babaji's face closely resembles that of Lahiri Mahashaya. On occasion, the similarity was so striking that Lahiri Mahashaya in his later years might have passed as the father of the youthful-looking Babaji. Swami Kabalananda, my saintly Sanskrit tutor, spent some time with Babaji in the Himalayas. The peerless master moves with his group from place to place in the mountains, Kabalananda told me. His small band contains two highly advanced American disciples. After Babaji has been in one locality for some time, he says, Dera Danda Uthao, let us lift our camp and staff. He carries a danda, bamboo staff. His words are the signal for moving with his group instantaneously to another place. He does not always employ this method of astral travel. Sometimes he goes on foot from peak to peak. Babaji can be seen or recognized by others only when he so desires. He is known to have appeared in many slightly different forms to various devotees, sometimes with beard and moustache, and sometimes without them. His undecayable body requires no food. The master, therefore, seldom eats. As a social courtesy to visiting disciples, he occasionally accepts fruits or rice cooked in milk and clarified butter. Two amazing incidents of Babaji's life are known to me, Kabalananda went on. His disciples were sitting one night around a huge fire that was blazing for a sacred Vedic ceremony. The guru suddenly seized a burning brand and lightly struck the bare shoulder of a chela who was close to the fire. Sir, how cruel! Lahiri Mahashaya, who was present, made this remonstrance. Would you rather have seen him burned to ashes before your eyes, according to the decree of his past karma? With these words, Babaji placed his healing hand on the chela's disfigured shoulder. I have freed you tonight from painful death. The karmic law has been satisfied through your slight suffering by fire. On another occasion, Babaji's sacred circle was disturbed by the arrival of a stranger. He had climbed with astonishing skill to the nearly inaccessible ledge near the guru's camp. Sir, you must be the great Babaji. The man's face was lit with inexpressible reverence. For months, I have pursued a ceaseless search for you among these forbidding crags. I implore you to accept me as a disciple. When the great guru made no response, the man pointed to the rock-lined chasm below the ledge. If you refuse me, I will jump from this mountain. Life has no further value if I cannot win your guidance to the divine. Jump, then, Babaji said unemotionally. I cannot accept you in your present state of development. The man immediately hurled himself over the cliff. Babaji instructed the shocked disciples to fetch the stranger's body. After they had returned with the mangled form, the master placed his hand on the dead man. Lo, he opened his eyes and prostrated himself humbly before the omnipotent guru. You are now ready for discipleship. Babaji beamed lovingly on his resurrected Chela. You have courageously passed a difficult test. Death shall not touch you again. Now you are one of our immortal flock. Then he spoke his usual words of departure. Dera danda utao. The whole group vanished from the mountain. An avatar lives in the omnipresent spirit. For him there is no distance inverse to the square. Only one reason, therefore, motivates Babaji in maintaining his physical form from century to century. The desire to furnish humanity with a concrete example of its own possibilities. Were man never vouchsafed a glimpse of divinity in the flesh, he would remain oppressed by the heavy maic delusion that he cannot transcend his mortality. Jesus knew from the beginning the sequence of his life. He passed through each event not for himself, not from any karmic compulsion, but solely for the upliftment of reflective human beings. The four evangelists, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, recorded the ineffable drama for the benefit of later generations. For Babaji also, there is no relativity of past, present, future. From the beginning, he has known all phases of his life. Accommodating himself to the limited understanding of men, he has played many acts of his divine life in the presence of one or more witnesses. Thus it came about that a disciple of Lahiri Mahashai was present when Babaji deemed the time to be ripe for him to proclaim the possibility of bodily immortality. He uttered this promise before Ram Gopal Mozumdar, that it might finally become known for the inspiration of other seeking hearts. The great ones speak their words and participate in the seemingly natural course of events solely for the good of man. Even as Christ said, Father, I knew that thou hearest me always, but because of the people which stand by I said it, that they may believe that thou hast sent me. During my visit at Ranbajpur with Ram Gopal, the sleepless saint, the omnipresent yogi who observed that I failed to bow before the Tarakeshwar shrine, he related the wondrous story of his first meeting with Babaji. I sometimes left my isolated cave to sit at the feet of Lahiri Mahashai in Banaras, Ram Gopal told me. One midnight, as I was silently meditating in a group of his disciples, the master made a surprising request. Ram Gopal, he said, go at once to the Dasasamed bathing ghat. I soon reached the secluded spot. The night was bright with moonlight and the glittering stars. After I had sat in patient silence for a while, my attention was drawn to a huge stone slab near my feet. It rose gradually, revealing an underground cave. As the stone became stationary, held up by some unknown means, the draped form of a young and surpassingly lovely woman emerged from the cave and levitated high in the air. Surrounded by a soft halo, she slowly descended in front of me and stood, motionless, steeped in ecstasy. She finally stirred and spoke gently. I am Mataji, the sister of Babaji. I have asked him and also Lahiri Mahashai to come to my cave tonight to discuss a matter of great importance. A nebulous light was rapidly floating over the Ganges. The strange luminescence was reflected in the opaque waters. It approached nearer and nearer until, with a blinding flash, it appeared by the side of Mataji and condensed itself instantly into the human form of Lahiri Mahashai. He bowed humbly at the feet of the woman saint. Before I had recovered from my bewilderment, I was further wonderstruck to behold a circling mass of mystical light travelling in the sky. Descending swiftly, the flaming whirlpool neared our group and materialized itself into the body of a beautiful youth. I understood at once that he was Babaji. He looked like Lahiri Mahashai, though Babaji appeared much younger than his disciple and had long, bright hair. Lahiri Mahashai, Mataji and I knelt at the great Guru's feet. An ethereal sensation of beatific glory thrilled every fibre of my being as I touched his divine flesh. "Blessed sister," Babaji said, "I am intending to shed my form and plunge into the infinite current. I have already glimpsed your plan, beloved master. I wanted to discuss it with you tonight. Why should you leave your body?" The glorious woman looked at him beseechingly. "What is the difference if I wear a visible or an invisible wave on the ocean of my spirit?" Mataji replied with a quaint flash of wit, "Deathless Guru, if it makes no difference, then please do not ever relinquish your form." "Be it so," Babaji said solemnly, "I shall never leave my physical body. It will always remain visible to at least a small number of people on this earth. The Lord has spoken his own wish through your lips." As I listened in awe to the conversation between these exalted beings, the great Guru turned to me with a benign gesture. "Fear not, Ram Gopal," he said. "You are blessed to be a witness at the scene of this immortal promise." As the sweet melody of Babaji's voice faded away, his form and that of Lahiri Mahashai slowly levitated and moved backward over the Ganges. An aureole of dazzling light surrounded their bodies as they vanished into the night sky. Mataji's form floated to the cave and descended. The stone slab came down and closed over the cave, as if moved by invisible hands. Infinitely inspired, I wended my way back to Lahiri Mahashai's place. As I bowed before him in the early dawn, my guru smiled at me, understandingly. "I'm happy for you, Ram Gopal," he said. "Your desire to meet Babaji and Mataji, which you have often expressed to me, has found, at last, a wondrous fulfillment." My fellow disciples informed me that Lahiri Mahashai had not moved from his dais since my departure at midnight. He gave a wonderful discourse on immortality after you had left for the Disasa Medghat, one of the chelas told me. "For the first time, I fully realized the truth in the scriptural verses which state that a man of self-realization can appear at different places in two or more bodies at the same time." Lahiri Mahashai later explained to me many metaphysical points concerning the hidden divine plan for this earth, Ram Gopal concluded. "Babaji has been chosen by God to remain in his body for the duration of this particular world cycle. Ages will come and go. Still the deathless master, beholding the drama of the centuries, shall be present on this stage terrestrial." Chapter 34. Materializing a Palace in the Himalayas. Babaji's first meeting with Lahiri Mahashai is an enthralling story, and one of the few that give us a detailed glimpse of the deathless guru. These words were Swami Kabalananda's preamble to a wondrous tale. The first time he recounted it, I was literally spellbound. On many other occasions, I coaxed my gentle Sanskrit tutor to repeat the story, which was later told me in substantially the same words by Sri Yukteswar. Both these disciples of Lahiri Mahashai had heard the awesome tale direct from the lips of their guru. My first meeting with Babaji took place in my 33rd year, Lahiri Mahashai had said. In the autumn of 1861, I was stationed in Danapur as an accountant in the military engineering department of the government. One morning, the office manager summoned me. "Lahiri," he said, "a telegram has just come from our main office. You are to be transferred to Raniket, where an army post is now being established." With one servant, I set out on the 500-mile trip. Travelling by horse and buggy, we arrived in 30 days at the Himalayan site of Raniket. My office duties were not onerous. I was able to spend many hours roaming the magnificent hills. A rumour reached me that great saints blessed the region with their presence. I felt a strong desire to see them. During a ramble one early afternoon, I was astounded to hear a distant voice calling my name. I continued my vigorous upward climb on Drongiri Mountain. A slight uneasiness beset me at the thought that I might not be able to retrace my steps before darkness descended over the jungle. I finally reached a small clearing whose sides were dotted with caves. On one of the rocky ledges stood a smiling young man, extending his hand in welcome. I noticed with astonishment that, except for his copper-coloured hair, he bore a remarkable resemblance to myself. "Lahiri, you have come." The saint addressed me affectionately in Hindi. "Rest here in this cave. It was I who called you." I entered a neat little grotto that contained several woolen blankets and a few kamandalas, water pots. "Lahiri, do you remember that seat?" The yogi pointed to a folded blanket in one corner. "No, sir." Somewhat dazed at the strangeness of my adventure, I added, "I must leave now before nightfall. I have business in the morning at my office." The mysterious saint replied in English, "The office was brought for you, and not you for the office." I was dumbfounded that this forest ascetic should not only speak English, but also paraphrase the words of Christ. I see my telegram took effect. The yogi's remark was incomprehensible to me. I asked its meaning. "I refer to the telegram that summoned you to these isolated parts. It was I who silently suggested to the mind of your superior officer that you be transferred to Raniket. When one feels his unity with mankind, all minds become transmitting stations through which he can work at will." He added, "Lahiri, surely this cave seems familiar to you?" As I maintained a bewildered silence, the saint approached and struck me gently on the forehead. At his magnetic touch, a wondrous current swept through my brain, releasing the sweet seed memories of my previous life. "I remember." My voice was half-choked with joyous sobs. "You are my guru, Babaji, who has belonged to me always." Scenes of the past arise vividly in my mind. Here, in this cave, I spent many years of my last incarnation. As ineffable recollections overwhelmed me, I tearfully embraced my master's feet. "For more than 3 decades, I have waited for you to return to me." Babaji's voice rang with celestial love. "You slipped away and disappeared into the tumultuous waves of the life beyond death. The magic wand of your karma touched you, and you were gone. Though you lost sight of me, never did I lose sight of you. I pursued you over the luminescent astral sea, where the glorious angels sail. Through gloom, storm, upheaval, and light I followed you, like a mother bird guarding her young. As you lived out your human term of womb life and emerged a babe, my eye was ever on you. When you covered your tiny form in the lotus posture, under the gurney sands in childhood, I was invisibly present. Patiently, month after month, year after year, I have watched over you, waiting for this perfect day. Now you're with me. Here is your cave, loved of yore. I have kept it ever clean and ready for you. Here is your hallowed asana blanket, where daily you sat to fill your expanding heart with God. Here is your bowl, from which you often drank the nectar prepared by me. See how I have kept the brass cup brightly polished, that some day you might drink again from it. My own, do you now understand?" "My guru, what can I say?" I murmured brokenly. "Where has one ever heard of such deathless love?" I gazed long and ecstatically at my eternal treasure, my guru, in life and death. "Lahiri, you need purification. Drink the oil in this bowl and lie down by the river." Babaji's practical wisdom, I reflected with a quick, reminiscent smile, was ever to the fore. I obeyed his directions. Though the icy Himalayan night was descending, a warm, comforting radiation began to pulsate within me. I marveled. Was the unknown oil endued with a cosmical heat? Bitter winds whipped around me in the darkness, shrieking a fierce challenge. The chill wavelets of the Gogesh River lapped now and then over my body, outstretched on the rocky bank. Tigers howled nearby, but my heart was free of fear. The radiant force, newly generated within me, conveyed an assurance of unassailable protection. Several hours passed swiftly. Faded memories of another life wove themselves into the present brilliant pattern of reunion with my divine guru. My solitary musings were interrupted by the sound of approaching footsteps. In the darkness, a man's hand gently helped me to my feet and gave me some dry clothing. "Come, brother," my companion said. "The master awaits you." He led the way through the forest. As we came to a turn in the path, the somber night was suddenly lit by a steady luminosity in the distance. "Can that be the sunrise?" I inquired. "Surely the whole night has not passed." "The hour is midnight," my guide laughed softly. "Yonder light is the glow of a golden palace, materialized here tonight by the peerless Babaji. In the dim past, you once expressed a desire to enjoy the beauties of a palace. Our master is now satisfying your wish, thus freeing you from the last bond of your karma." He added, "The magnificent palace will be the scene of your initiation tonight into Kriya Yoga. All your brothers here join in a paean of welcome, rejoicing at the end of your exile. Behold!" Before us stood a vast palace of dazzling gold, ornamented with countless jewels, set amid landscaped gardens, reflected in tranquil pools, a spectacle of unparalleled grandeur. Towering archways were intricately inlaid with great diamonds, sapphires, and emeralds. Men of angelic countenance were stationed by gates, redly resplendent with rubies. I followed my companion into a spacious reception hall. The odors of incense and roses wafted through the air. Dim lamps shed a multicolored glow. Small groups of devotees, some fair, some dark-skinned, chanted softly or sat silently in the meditative posture, immersed in inner peace. A vibrant joy pervaded the atmosphere. "Feast your eyes, enjoy the artistic splendors of this palace, for it has been brought into being solely in your honor," my guide remarked, smiling sympathetically. As I exclaimed in wonder, "Brother," I said, "the beauty of this structure surpasses the bounds of human imagination. Please explain to me the mystery of its origin." "I will gladly enlighten you." My companion's dark eyes sparkled with wisdom. "There is nothing inexplicable about this materialization. The whole cosmos is a projected thought of the Creator. The heavy clod of the earth, floating in space, is a dream of God's. He made all things out of his mind, even as man, in his dream consciousness, reproduces and vivifies the creation with its creatures. The Lord first formed the earth as an idea. He quickened it. Atomic energy and then matter came into being. He coordinated earth atoms into a solid sphere. All its molecules are held together by the will of God. When he withdraws his will, all earth atoms will be transformed into energy. Atomic energy will return to its source, consciousness. The earth idea will disappear from objectivity. The substance of a dream is held in materialization by the subconscious thought of the dreamer. When that cohesive thought is withdrawn, in wakefulness, the dream and its elements dissolve. A man closes his eyes and erects a dream creation, which, on awakening, he effortlessly dematerializes. He follows the divine archetypal pattern. Similarly, when he awakens in cosmic consciousness, he effortlessly dematerializes the illusion of a cosmic dream universe. In tune with the infinite, all-accomplishing will, Babaji is able to command the elemental atoms to combine and manifest themselves in any form. This golden palace, instantaneously brought into being, is real, in the same sense that the earth is real. Babaji created this beautiful mansion out of his mind and is holding its atoms together by the power of his will, even as God's thought created the earth and his will maintains it. He added, when this structure has served its purpose, Babaji will dematerialize it. As I remained silent in awe, my guide made a sweeping gesture. This shimmering palace, superbly embellished with jewels, has not been built by human effort. Its gold and gems were not laboriously mined. It stands, solidly, a monumental challenge to man. Whoever realizes himself as a son of God, even as Babaji has done, can reach any goal by the infinite powers hidden within him. A common stone secretly contains stupendous atomic energies. Even so, the lowliest mortal is a powerhouse of divinity. The sage picked up from a nearby table a graceful vase whose handle was blazing with diamonds. Our great guru created this palace by solidifying myriads of free cosmic rays, he went on. Touch this vase and its diamonds. They will pass all the tests of sensory experience. I examined the vase. Its jewels were worthy of a king's collection. I passed my hand over the room walls, thick with glistening gold. Deep satisfaction spread over my mind. A desire, hidden in my subconsciousness from lives now gone, seemed simultaneously gratified and extinguished. My stately companion led me through ornate arches and corridors into a series of chambers richly furnished in the style of an emperor's palace. We entered an immense hall. In the center stood a golden throne, encrusted with jewels that shed a dazzling medley of colors. There, in lotus posture, sat the supreme Babaji. I knelt on the shining floor at his feet. Lahiri, are you still feasting on your dream desires for a golden palace? My guru's eyes were twinkling like his own sapphires. Wake! All your earthly thirsts are about to be quenched forever. He murmured some mystic words of blessing. My son, arise, receive your initiation into the kingdom of God through Kriya Yoga. Babaji stretched out his hand. A homa, sacrificial fire, appeared, surrounded by fruits and flowers. I received the liberating yogic technique before this flaming altar. The rites were completed in the early dawn. In my ecstatic state, I felt no need for sleep. I wandered about the palace rooms, filled with treasures and exquisite objets d'art, and visited the gardens. I noticed nearby the caves and barren mountain ledges that I had seen yesterday, but then they had not adjoined a great building and flowered terraces. Re-entering the palace, fabulously glistening in the cold Himalayan sunlight, I sought the presence of my master. He was still enthroned, surrounded by many quiet disciples. Lahiri, you're hungry, Babaji added. Close your eyes. When I reopened them, the enchanting palace and its gardens had disappeared. My own body and the forms of Babaji and his disciples were now all seated on the bare ground, at the exact site of the vanished palace, not far from the sunlit entrances of the rocky grottos. I recalled that my guide had remarked that the palace would be dematerialized, its captive atoms released into the thought essences from which they had sprung. Although stunned, I looked trustingly at my guru. I knew not what to expect next on this day of miracles. The purpose for which the palace was created has now been served, Babaji explained. He lifted an earthen vessel from the ground. Put your hand there and receive whatever food you desire. I touched the broad, empty bowl. Hot buttered luchis, curry and sweetmeats appeared. As I ate them, I noticed that the bowl remained ever filled. At the end of the meal, I looked around for water. My guru pointed to the bowl before me. The food had vanished. In its place was water. Few mortals know that the kingdom of God includes the kingdom of mundane fulfillments, Babaji observed. The divine realm extends to the earthly, but the latter, illusory in nature, does not contain the essence of reality. Beloved Guru, last night you demonstrated for me the link of beauty in heaven and earth. I smiled at memories of the vanished palace. Surely no simple yogi had ever received initiation into the august mysteries of spirit amidst surroundings of more impressive luxury. I gazed tranquilly at the stark contrast of the present scene. The gaunt ground, the sky roof, the caves offering primitive shelter, all seemed a gracious natural setting for the seraphic saints around me. I sat that afternoon on my blanket, hallowed by associations of past life realizations. My divine guru approached and passed his hand over my head. I entered the Nirvikalpa Samadhi state, remaining unbrokenly in its bliss for 7 days. Crossing the successive strata of self-knowledge, I penetrated the deathless realms of reality. All delusive limitations dropped away. My soul was fully established on the altar of the cosmic spirit. On the 8th day, I fell at my guru's feet and implored him to keep me always near him in this sacred wilderness. My son, Babaji said, embracing me, your role in this incarnation must be played before the gaze of the multitude. Prenatally blessed by many lives of lonely meditation, you must now mingle in the world of men. A deep purpose underlay the fact that you did not meet me this time until you were already a married man, with modest family and business responsibilities. You must put aside your thoughts of joining our secret band in the Himalayas. Your life lies amid the city crowds, serving as an example of the ideal yogi householder. The cries of many bewildered worldly men and women have not fallen unheard on the ears of the great ones, he went on. You have been chosen to bring spiritual solace through Kriya Yoga to numerous earnest seekers. The millions who are encumbered by family ties and heavy worldly duties will take new heart from you, a householder like themselves. You should guide them to understand that the highest yogic attainments are not barred to the family man. Even in the world, the yogi who faithfully discharges his responsibilities without personal motive or attachment treads the sure path of enlightenment. No necessity compels you to leave the world, for inwardly you have already sundered its every karmic tie. Not of this world, you must yet be in it. Many years still remain, during which you should conscientiously fulfill your family, business, civic, and spiritual duties. A sweet new breath of divine hope will penetrate the arid hearts of worldly men. From your balanced life, they will understand that liberation is dependent on inner rather than outer renunciations. How remote seemed my family, the office, the world, as I listened to my guru in the high Himalayan solitudes. Yet adamantine truth rang in his words. I submissively agreed to leave this blessed haven of peace. Babaji instructed me in the ancient rigid rules that govern the transmission of the yogic art from guru to disciple. Bestow the Kriya key only on qualified chelas, Babaji said. He who vows to sacrifice all in the quest of the divine is fit to unravel the final mysteries of life through the science of meditation. Angelic Guru, as you have already favored mankind by resurrecting the lost Kriya art, will you not increase that benefit by relaxing the strict requirements for discipleship? I gazed beseechingly at Babaji. I pray that you permit me to communicate Kriya to all sincere seekers, even though at first they may not be able to vow themselves to complete inner renunciation. The tortured men and women of the world, pursued by the threefold suffering, need special encouragement. They may never attempt the road to freedom if Kriya initiation be withheld from them. Be it so. The divine wish has been expressed through you. Give Kriya to all who humbly ask you for help. The merciful Guru replied. After a silence, Babaji added, repeat to each of your disciples this majestic promise from the Bhagavad Gita. Svalpamapyasya dharmasya trayate mahato bhayat. Even a little practice of this dharma, religious rite or righteous action, will save you from great fear, mahato bhayat, the colossal sufferings inherent in the repeated cycles of birth and death. As I knelt the next morning at my guru's feet for a farewell blessing, he sensed my deep reluctance to leave him. There is no separation for us, my beloved child. He touched my shoulder affectionately. Wherever you are, whenever you call me, I shall be with you instantly. Consoled by his wondrous promise, and rich with the newly found gold of God wisdom, I wended my way down the mountain. At the office, I was welcomed by my fellow employees, who for 10 days had thought me lost in the Himalayan jungles. A letter soon arrived from the head office. Lahiri should return to the Danapur office, it read. His transfer to Raniket occurred by error. Another man should have been sent to assume the Raniket duties. I smiled, reflecting on the hidden cross-currents in the events that had led me to this farthermost spot of India. Before returning to Danapur, I spent a few days with a Bengali family in Moradabad. A party of 6 friends gathered to greet me. As I turned the conversation to spiritual subjects, my host observed gloomily, "Oh, in these days, India is destitute of saints." "Bapu," I protested warmly, "of course there are still great masters in this land." In a mood of exalted fervour, I felt impelled to relate my miraculous experiences in the Himalayas. The little company was politely incredulous. "Lahiri," one man said soothingly, "your mind has been under a strain in those rarefied mountain airs. This is some daydream you have recounted." Burning with the enthusiasm of truth, I spoke without due thought. "If I call him, my guru will appear right in this house." Interest gleamed in every eye. It was no wonder that the group was eager to behold such a phenomenon. Half reluctantly, I asked for a quiet room and 2 new woolen blankets. "The master will materialize from the ether," I said. "Remain silently outside the door. I shall soon call you." I sank into the meditative state, humbly summoning my guru. The darkened room became filled with a dim, soothing glow. The luminous figure of Babaji emerged. "Lahiri, do you call me for a trifle?" The master's gaze was stern. "Truth is for earnest seekers, not for those of idle curiosity. It is easy to believe when one sees. No soul-searchings are then necessary. Supersensual truth is deservedly discovered by those who overcome their natural materialistic scepticism." He added gravely, "Let me go." I fell entreatingly at his feet. "Holy Guru, I realize my serious error. I humbly ask pardon. It was to create faith in these spiritually blinded minds that I ventured to call you. Because you have graciously appeared at my prayer, please do not depart without bestowing a blessing on my friends. Unbelievers though they be, at least they were willing to investigate the truth of my strange assertions." "Very well. I will stay a while. I do not wish your word discredited before your friends." Babaji's face had softened, But he added gently, "Henceforth, my son, I shall come whenever you need me, not always when you call me." Tense silence reigned in the little group when I opened the door. As if mistrusting their senses, my friends stared at the lustrous figure on the blanket seat. "This is mass hypnotism," one man laughed blatantly. "No one could possibly have entered this room without our knowledge." Babaji advanced smilingly and motioned to each one to touch the warm, solid flesh of his body. Doubts dispelled, my friends prostrated themselves on the floor in awed repentance. "Let halwa be prepared." Babaji made this request, I knew, further to assure the group of his physical reality. While the porridge was boiling, the divine guru chatted affably. Great was the metamorphosis of these doubting Thomases into devout St. Pauls. After we had eaten, Babaji blessed each of us in turn. There was a sudden flash. We witnessed the instantaneous dechemicalization of the electronic elements of Babaji's body into a spreading, vaporous light. The God-tuned willpower of the Master had loosened its grasp of the ether atoms held together as his body. Forthwith, the trillions of tiny, lifetronic sparks faded into the infinite reservoir. With my own eyes, I have seen the conqueror of death. Maitra, one of the group, spoke reverently. His face was transfigured with the joy of his recent awakening. The Supreme Guru played with time and space as a child plays with bubbles. I have beheld one with the keys of heaven and earth. I soon returned to Danapur, Lahiri Mahashaya had concluded. Firmly anchored in the spirit, again I assumed the manifold family and business obligations of a householder. Lahiri Mahashai also related to Swami Kevalananda and Sri Yukteswar the story of another meeting with Babaji. The occasion was one of many on which the Supreme Guru fulfilled his promise. "I shall come whenever you need me." The scene was a Kumbha Mela at Allahabad. Lahiri Mahashai told his disciples, "I had gone there during a short vacation from my office duties. As I wandered amidst the throng of monks and sadhus that had come from great distances to attend the holy festival, I noticed an ash-smeared ascetic who was holding a begging bowl. The thought arose in my mind that the man was hypocritical, wearing the outward symbols of renunciation without a corresponding inward grace. No sooner had I passed the ascetic than my astounded eye fell on Babaji. He was kneeling in front of a matted-haired anchorite. "Guruji," I hastened to his side, "sir, what are you doing here?" "I am washing the feet of this renunciant, and then I shall clean his cooking utensils." Babaji smiled at me like a little child. I knew he was intimating that he wanted me to criticize no one, but to see the Lord as residing equally in all body temples, whether of superior or inferior men. The great guru added, "By serving wise and ignorant sadhus, I am learning the greatest of virtues, pleasing to God above all others, humility." Chapter 35. The Christ-like Life of Lahiri Mahashai. Thus it becometh us to fulfill all righteousness. In these words to John the Baptist, and in asking John to baptize him, Jesus was acknowledging the divine rights of his guru. From a reverent study of the Bible, from an Oriental viewpoint, and from intuitional perception, I am convinced that John the Baptist was, in past lives, the guru of Christ. Numerous passages in the Bible imply that John and Jesus in their last incarnations were, respectively, Elijah and his disciple Elisha. These are the spellings in the Old Testament. The Greek translators spelled the names as Elias and Eliseus. They reappear in the New Testament in these changed forms. The very end of the Old Testament is a prediction of the reincarnation of Elijah and Elisha. Behold, I will send you Elijah the prophet before the coming of the great and dreadful day of the Lord. Thus John, Elijah, sent before the coming of the Lord, was born slightly earlier to serve as a herald for Christ. An angel appeared to Zacharias the father to testify that his coming son, John, will be none other than Elijah, Elias. But the angel said unto him, Fear not, Zacharias, for thy prayer is heard, and thy wife, Elizabeth, shall bear thee a son, and thou shalt call his name John. And many of the children of Israel shall he turn to the Lord their God. And he shall go before him in the spirit and the power of Elias, to turn the hearts of the fathers to the children, and the disobedient to the wisdom of the just, to make ready a people prepared for the Lord. Jesus twice unequivocally identified Elijah, Elias, as John. Elias is come already, and they knew him not. Then the disciples understood that he spake unto them of John the Baptist. Again Christ says, For all the prophets and the law prophesied until John. And if ye will receive it, this is Elias, which was for to come. When John denied that he was Elias, Elijah, he meant that in the humble garb of John he came no longer in the outward elevation of Elijah the great guru. In his former incarnation, he had given the mantle of his glory and his spiritual wealth to his disciple Elisha. And Elisha said, I pray thee, let a double portion of thy spirit be upon me. And he said, Thou hast asked a hard thing. Nevertheless, if thou see me when I am taken from thee, it shall be so unto thee. And he took the mantle of Elijah that fell from him. The roles became reversed, because Elijah John was no longer needed to be the ostensible guru of Elisha Jesus, now divinely perfected. When Christ was transfigured on the mountain, it was his guru Elias with Moses that he saw. In his hour of extremity on the cross, Jesus cried out, Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani, that is to say, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? Some of them that stood there, when they heard that, said, This man calleth for Elias. Let us see whether Elias will come to save him. The timeless bond of guru and disciple that existed between John and Jesus was present also for Babaji and Lahiri Mahashai. With tender solicitude, the deathless guru swam the abysmal waters that swelled between two lives of his chela, and guided the successive steps taken by the child and then by the man, Lahiri Mahashai. It was not until the disciple had reached his 33rd year that Babaji deemed the time ripe for re-establishing openly the never-severed link. After the brief meeting near Raniket, the selfless guru did not keep the beloved disciple by his side, but released Lahiri Mahashai for an outward world mission. My son, I shall come whenever you need me. What mortal lover can fulfill the infinite implications of such a promise? Unknown to society in general, a great spiritual renaissance started in 1861 in a remote corner of Benares. As the fragrance of flowers cannot be suppressed, so Lahiri Mahashai, quietly living as an ideal householder, could not hide his innate glory. Devotee bees from every part of India began to seek the divine nectar of the liberated master. The English office superintendent was one of the first to notice a strange, transcendental change in his employee, whom he affectionately called Ecstatic Babu. Sir, you seem sad. What is the trouble? Lahiri Mahashai made this sympathetic inquiry one morning to his employer. My wife in England is critically ill. I am torn by anxiety. I shall get you some word about her. Lahiri Mahashai left the room and sat for a short time in a secluded spot. On his return, he smiled consolingly. Your wife is improving, She is now writing you a letter." The omniscient yogi quoted some parts of the missive. "Ecstatic Babu, I already know that you are no ordinary man. Yet I am unable to believe that, at will, you can banish time and space." The promised letter finally arrived. The astounded superintendent found that it contained not only the good news of his wife's recovery, but also the same phrases that weeks earlier the great master had uttered. The wife came to India some months later. Meeting Lahiri Mahashay, she gazed at him reverently. "Sir," she said, "it was your form, hallowed in glorious light, that I beheld months ago by my sickbed in London. At that moment I was completely healed. Soon after, I was able to undertake the long ocean voyage to India." Day after day, the sublime guru initiated one or two devotees into Kriya Yoga. In addition to these spiritual duties, and to the responsibilities of his business and family life, the great master took an enthusiastic interest in education. He organized many study groups and played an active part in the growth of a large high school in the Bengali Tola section of Banaras. At weekly meetings, which came to be called his Gita Assembly, the guru expounded the scriptures to many eager truth-seekers. By these manifold activities, Lahiri Mahashay sought to answer the common challenge. After performing one's business and social duties, where is the time for devotional meditation? The harmoniously balanced life of the great householder guru became the inspiration of thousands of men and women. Earning only a modest salary, thrifty, unostentatious, accessible to all, the master carried on naturally and happily in the path of disciplined worldly life. Though ensconced in the seat of the Supreme One, Lahiri Mahashay showed reverence to all men, irrespective of their differing merits. When his devotees saluted him, he bowed in turn to them. With a childlike humility, the master often touched the feet of others, but seldom allowed them to pay him similar honour, even though such obeisance towards the guru is an ancient oriental custom. A significant feature of Lahiri Mahashay's life was his gift of Kriya initiations to those of every faith. Not Hindus only, but Muslims and Christians were among his foremost disciples. Monists and dualists, those of various faiths, or of no established faith, were impartially received and instructed by the universal guru. One of his highly advanced chelas was Abdul Ghaffar Khan, a Muslim. Lahiri Mahashay, belonging himself to the highest or Brahmin caste, made courageous efforts to dissolve the rigid caste bigotry of his time. Those from every walk of life found shelter under the master's omnipresent wings. Like all other God-inspired prophets, Lahiri Mahashay gave new hope to the outcasts and the downtrodden of society. "Remember that you belong to no one, and that no one belongs to you. Reflect that some day you will suddenly have to leave everything in this world. So make the acquaintance of God now," the great guru told his disciples. "Prepare yourself for the coming astral journey of death by riding daily in a balloon of divine perception. Through delusion, you are perceiving yourself as a bundle of flesh and bones, which at best is a nest of troubles. Meditate unceasingly, that you quickly behold yourself as the infinite essence, free from every form of misery. Cease being a prisoner of the body. Using the secret key of Kriya, learn to escape into spirit." The master encouraged his various disciples to adhere to the good traditional discipline of their own faiths. Stressing the all-inclusive nature of Kriya Yoga as a practical technique of liberation, Lahiri Mahashay then gave his chelas liberty to express their lives in conformance with environment and upbringing. A Muslim should perform his namaj worship 5 times daily, the master pointed out. Several times daily, a Hindu should sit in meditation. A Christian should go down on his knees several times daily, praying to God and then reading the Bible. With wise discernment, the guru guided his followers into the paths of bhakti, devotion, karma, action, jnana, wisdom, or raja, royal or complete, yoga. According to each man's natural tendencies, the master, who was slow to give his permission to devotees wishing to enter the formal path of monkhood, always cautioned them first to reflect well on the austerities of the monastic life. The great guru taught his disciples to avoid theoretical discussion of the scriptures. He only is wise who devotes himself to realizing, not reading only, the ancient revelations, he said. Solve all your problems through meditation. Exchange unprofitable speculations for actual God communion. Clear your mind of dogmatic theological debris. Let in the fresh healing waters of direct perception. Attune yourself to the active inner guidance. The divine voice has the answer to every dilemma of life. Though man's ingenuity for getting himself into trouble appears to be endless, the infinite succor is no less resourceful. The master's omnipresence was demonstrated one day before a group of disciples who were listening to his exposition on the Bhagavad Gita. As he was explaining the meaning of Kutastha Chaitanya, or the Christ consciousness in all vibratory creation, Lahiri Mahashai suddenly gasped and cried out, "I am drowning in the bodies of many souls off the coast of Japan." The next morning, the Chelas read a cabled newspaper account of the deaths of a number of persons whose ship had foundered the preceding day near Japan. Many distant disciples of Lahiri Mahashai were aware of his enfolding presence. "I am ever with those who practice Kriya," he would say consolingly to Chelas who could not remain near him. "I will guide you to the cosmic home through your ever-enlarging spiritual perceptions." Sri Bhupendra Nath Sanyal, an eminent disciple of the great guru, stated that, as a youth in 1892, unable to go to Benares, he prayed to the master for spiritual instruction. Lahiri Mahashai appeared before Bhupendra in a dream and gave him Diksha, initiation. Later the boy went to Benares and asked the guru for Diksha. "I have already initiated you in a dream," Lahiri Mahashai replied. If a disciple neglected any of his worldly obligations, the master would gently correct and discipline him. Lahiri Mahashai's words were mild and healing, even when he was forced to speak openly of a chela's faults, Sri Yukteswar once told me. He added, ruefully, "No disciple ever fled from our master's barbs." I could not help laughing, but I truthfully assured my guru that, sharp or not, his every word was music to my ears. Lahiri Mahashai carefully graded Kriya into four progressive initiations. He bestowed the three higher techniques only after a devotee had manifested definite spiritual progress. One day, a certain chela, convinced that his worth was not being duly evaluated, gave voice to his discontent. "Master," he said, "surely I am ready now for the second initiation." At this moment, the door opened to admit a humble disciple, Brinda Bhagat. He was a Benares postman. "Brinda, sit by me here." The great guru smiled at him affectionately. "Tell me, are you ready for the second Kriya?" The little postman folded his hands supplicatingly. "Guru Deva," he said in alarm, "no more initiations, please. How can I assimilate any higher teachings? I have come today to ask your blessings, because the first Kriya has filled me with such divine intoxication that I cannot deliver the letters." Already, Brinda swims in the sea of spirit. At these words from Lahiri Mahashai, the other disciple hung his head. "Master," he said, "I see, I have been a poor workman, finding fault with my tools." The lowly postman, who was uneducated, later developed his insight through Kriya to such an extent